What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor Jonathan Petropoulos of Claremont McKenna College, discussing the fate of Nazi-looted art from World War II and the recent discoveries and developments in restoring it to its original Jewish owners. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. Or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I've been thinking lately about just what it means to be Jewish for most American Jews today. There's quite a lot of evidence testifying to the fact that most of us are proud of being Jewish and have no desire to hide our Jewish heritage or anything like that. How we express it, however, has changed, and how much effort, energy, and even money we wish to put into that pursuit has changed, too. The latest data testifies to the fact that in spite of rising anti-Semitism in Europe and blips of it here, usually associated with anti-Israel moments, American Jews are comfortable in their own skins and we're not worried about fitting into or achieving success in our own society. We may or may not make our Jewish identity public, but we have little or no concern about experiencing some sort of anti-Jewish bias in the workplace or in social settings in general. On the other hand, more and more Jews are less and less religious, and more of us say that our Jewish identity is primarily ethnic or cultural, whatever that means. As Jewish organizations and institutions try to rearrange our appeal in 21st century American society, a society of almost infinite choice, we have moved to find ways to connect in those areas that today's American Jews say matter most to them. But is that working? Well, yes, no. For example, the Pew study that came out a year ago indicated that the Holocaust was a central part of most Jews' identity, and that the vast majority of American Jews feel strongly about Israel. But there are already a plethora of Jewish organizations that work to connect U.S. Jews with Israel and do so from a broad array of perspectives. It doesn't seem to be making people more Jewish. And while the Holocaust may be focal for people's identity, I can tell you that Jewish communal events associated with the Shoah draw fewer attendees every single year. In addition, while many Jews say that they are only culturally connected to their Jewish identity, it's extremely difficult to delineate what this means, except that they don't like to say that they are religious. Mostly, I believe, thinking that saying they're religious means that they are not Orthodox or don't wish to remain linked to an unhappy childhood experience of Hebrew school or something. Does being culturally Jewish really mean anything at all, beyond the fact that people know that they were born and raised Jewish and might do the same for their kids if the circumstances work out, and that there are some Jewish elements of life they feel connected to? The other fascinating and mostly undocumented feature of the contemporary American Jewish world is the unprecedented and dynamic growth of the Chabad movement, which, among other things, has presented American Jews, who are certainly not Orthodox in practice, with the opportunity to have Jewish religious experiences, including bar mitzvahs, for example, essentially for, well, free. The funding for this pre-modern Chabad movement comes primarily from liberal Jews who feel that it expresses an authentic religious Judaism they don't necessarily wish to experience regularly themselves, but believe should be available now and for future generations. It's a very interesting, important, and idiosyncratic part of contemporary American Judaism. You know, in essence, you can read all the studies and articles surveying attitudes about Jewish identity that you want, but sooner or later, it'll come down to viewing it through the individual perspective of real live people, you know, human beings. Here, it becomes complicated. In my own Southern Arizona community, it's easier to raise funds for new workout rooms at the Jewish Community Center than it is to raise them to modernize a synagogue or build a sanctuary. That's fascinating. Since the membership of the JCC is less than half Jewish these days, is actually declining, and it's difficult to imagine an LA fitness or a for-profit gym raising millions of dollars in donations from, Methodists to finance a gym expansion. In other communities, this secular Jewish preference in fundraising may not be so true. Synagogues in Southern California and New York have raised tremendous sums for religious and educational facilities, and camp facilities too. But I believe there is something about contemporary American Jews that's leaning more towards Tucson's model of giving money to lots of Jewish causes, provided they are not too Jewish. That is, they express Jewish values or connect Jews communally, but don't actually require Jewish learning or real Jewish spiritual experiences. All of this raises a question of diffidence. Is the issue simply a lack of passion and commitment among today's Jews? A desire to remain at arm's length from anything that might require a dip into serious worship or learning in connection with our amazing heritage? Are we simply too ironic and disconnected from our own hearts and minds to connect with the emotion and depth of real Judaism? Or are Jewish organizations and institutions taking an easy road towards least common denominator connection, failing to challenge and inspire contemporary Jews? I suspect it's a little bit of all of this, but I also believe that our profound need for meaning and community will not be permanently or deeply satisfied by Facebook or Instagram alone, nor will working out in the same space as others give us true solidarity with other Jews. For that, we will still need, more than ever, synagogues, Jewish education, and acts of worship, study, and moral commitment. That is what has kept Judaism vital for thousands of years. And when we find the proper expression of it for the current generations of Jews, we will discover that they respond willingly too. In any case, to play us in on this lovely autumn morning, here's a Vishamru, very much in the American Jewish style, a song of the Sabbath from the Shal Shelet Music Choral Festival, composed by cantor Marcelo Gindlin, as sung by Susan Collin. That was Vishamru by Marcelo Gindlin, a song of Shabbat celebration. Before World War II, European Jews were among the most enthusiastic sponsors and collectors of fine art, especially impressionistic, modern, and expressionist paintings in the whole world. The Nazis knew this and stole many valuable collections from their Jewish owners before sending most to the gas chambers. The process of saving and restoring that art to the families of its original owners is still going on nearly seven decades after the end of the Holocaust. It involves collections at some of the most famous museums in the world, intrigue, and vast hidden stores of great art held by the families of former Nazis and Nazi art dealers. Learn the latest dramatic developments in this fascinating and often twisted story, a bit of which was dramatized in the movie The Monuments Man earlier this year. Learn about it from an expert on the subject, Professor Jonathan Petropoulos, when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish. Join the Tucson Hebrew Academy as we celebrate and honor an all-around mensch, Pima County Supervisor Ray Carroll, Sunday evening, November 2nd at the JCC. Supervisor Carroll's great contribution to THA as a board member and the work he's done as a public servant for Tucson and Pima County is an inspiration to people of all faiths and backgrounds. Ray Carroll's commitment to our community is an example of how to make the world a better place. Also at this year's Tikkun Olam event, we welcome back world-renowned comedian, author, Too Jewish radio show guest, and Jewish Day School graduate, the very funny Joel Chasnoff, as MC and entertainer. In addition to this hilarious comic and our worthy honoree, Tikkun Olam offers dinner, a silent auction, and a great chance to socialize. I can tell you personally, it's one of the best and most enjoyable nights of the whole Tucson year. This is the Tucson Hebrew Academy's largest fundraiser. We'd love to have you join us. For tickets or sponsorship, call 529-3888. That's 529-3888. Or visit our website, thaaz.org.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
We're out there having fun.
Enterprise of the Pasquagaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Jonathan Petropoulos. He's speaking about the Nazi looted art of World War II, its ultimate disposition, and some of the ways it's been depicted and some of the newest developments. Good morning and welcome.
Good to be with you, Rabbi Cohen.
By the way, you're at Claremont McKenna College. I have to tell you, both of my sisters attended Claremont colleges, and it's a great place to be.
I say it's great to teach at a college that I couldn't get into. So there are wonderful institutions.
In recent years, a great deal has come out about Nazi looted art. It's stunning. We're nearly 70 years after the end of the Holocaust. The recovery, you would think, would long have been passed. That's not true, is it?
There's still a great deal of unfinished business from World War II. The Nazis were not just the greatest, most systematic mass murders in history. They were the greatest thieves, and they stole so much property from masterpieces to more quotidian objects, and we're still dealing with the legacy today.
A lot of the finest collectors, dealers in the interwar period were Jews. Is that a fair assessment?
It is. Art dealing in the cultural realm was one area where Central European Jews flourished. They were incredibly important to the cultural activities of the time. And as a result, when the Nazis attacked them, there was tremendous dislocation, and especially with artworks. There's just an incredible number of artworks that were the subject of either seizure or forced sales, and it's created a complex of issues that's keeping me busy now and I think for the rest of my career.
You know, it's fascinating. One would think, you know, we had Nuremberg trials, we had supposedly an opening up of everything that had happened during the Nazi era. They kept such spectacular records. Why has it taken so long for some of this to come to light?
Well, the Monuments Men, who are depicted in the George Clooney, Grant Heslov film, did heroic work. They spent about 5 years trying to recover and restitute the art taken by the Nazis, and they went a long way to fulfilling their mission. But there was so much that was taken, stolen, displaced, it was impossible to complete the work in that time period. And by about 1950, the U.S. government had other priorities, with the Cold War intensifying, and we basically shut down our restitution operations. And it took, you know, really another generation to discover that there was still a lot to be done. And so it was really in the 1990s that professionals reengaged and realized that the work had not been completed by 1950. And that work has continued, but you know, again, the scale is so immense that there's still a lot left to do.
We will talk about what's left to do, explore some of the recent finds, and talk about how museums are interesting and complicated players in this when we come back this morning on Too Jewish with Dr. Jonathan Petropoulos.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road Office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it, is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country. The only place in the world is certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. Word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, Jewish Radio 18 at Gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website, or just download us at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our Mivinan, Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
You know, in the Talmud, there's a quote. It says, Lo kedorot harishonim kedorot ha'achronim. The old timers, the old generation is not like the new generation. The old generation was brave and stalwart and strong, and the new generation isn't smart and they don't study and all these things. Old-time Israelis now say the same thing about younger Israelis, that there's a cultural difference in how they perceive their own country, their own Zionism. Do you think that's true?
First, no. And I have like an example for the summer. And you know, there is another expression, olech v'pochet ador, that a lot of the Zionists, you know, and those who build the kibbutzim and build the nation, the Israel, like used to say about the second and the third generation, the same you mentioned.
Right.
But I think this summer, when we saw all these, you know, young 18 years old, you know, fighting for Israel, and there was a lot of, you know, very, I would say, heroism.
Heroic. Yeah,
heroic. Acts, a lot of heroic
heroism.
Act and stories during the
Gaza,
the
wars.
War. Yeah, the war in Gaza, and you know, and I really, and I even posted on Facebook that if it's really like a הולך ופוחת הדור, if it's really less and less, then, you know, if it's really like the old generation are better than today. And I think no, I think the generation today are open for much more opportunity. They have a lot to choose from. You know, it's not like they are not in a closed bubble. They are, and even though, and I'm talking about those who decided to really go to the army and do a meaningful service, even though they can easily, you know, do not so easily, but they can do, they can choose different, because the opportunities today are vast and are enormous relating to the, you know, the old times.
Far more, for example.
That's why I think when you as you said, it used to be in El Al flights, two choice, yes or no. When
right.
you have,
did you want dinner? Yes or yeah. What are my choices for dinner? Yes or no. Yeah. Like that was it. That was service in Israel.
When you have only two choice and you choose one of them, so it's not a bit, but if you have like, you know, thousand of choices and you choose, you know, to do something for others, for the country that you love. And I think that's what really for me showed like the amazing generation we have, and to think that they will be our next leader. I'm really feel very comfortable that they will be the next leadership generation.
That's a great tribute, Oshrat. Thank you. And a reminder, you know, change isn't always bad. Sometimes it really is good.
Nachon.
Thanks. We'll talk next week.
Yeah.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So we started talking last week about the Jews of Curacao and this world premiere of a film, which comes kind of from a coffee table book about the Jewish community there, called A Shtetl in the Caribbean. Let's talk a little bit more about
right,
what
exactly.
all that's about.
Right, exactly. So on Sunday, October 26th.
This very day.
Right, which is today, exactly. I will be attending the world premiere of this documentary film that was inspired initially by the coffee table book, but also by the stories of these two childhood friends, one of whom now lives in the Washington, D.C. area, and the other lives in Amsterdam. And the fact is that most of the younger Jews in Curacao have moved away, mostly to Miami, New York, or Amsterdam, in some cases to Israel, in other cases to D.C. and other places in the world, but they go back to Curacao to be married or buried. But there's not a huge Jewish community there anymore. However, there's a very rich past, and the past has had ups and downs. And one of the ups was in the 30s when this huge wave of refugees from the impending Holocaust were welcomed by the Dutch and settled and revived, really, this very old Jewish community in Curacao. They were referred to by the locals as the Polakos, even though they weren't from Poland, because the locals were mostly Sephardic Jews
who might have gone back to the 16th century.
Who had arrived in the 16th and 17th century and were of Spanish or Portuguese ancestry, who were welcomed by the Dutch as a Protestant country when they fled Ferdinand and Isabella following the expulsion from Spain and the Spanish Inquisition and all those horrible events. So there was kind of a bifurcated community in Curacao for a while. But in any case, the coffee table book aroused enough interest in a serious Dutch film company with a great director and producer that they wanted to make a documentary not only about the Jewish community of Curacao, but also about the personal journey of these two childhood friends who grew up on Curacao in this little Dutch island with a big heart, but who went to meet people who knew their grandparents or great-grandparents in Israel, in Ukraine, in Belarus. They met neighbors, they hired interpreters, they met local rabbis, often Lubavitch rabbis who were restoring Jewish life in cities which are big enough to sustain a Jewish community, which were not the little villages that their ancestors came from. But the documentary covers all these things, and the weekend is going to be kind of friends and family, people I already met at a variety of weddings.
Some of them in Curacao?
Yeah, one in Curacao and one in the D.C. area. And there's going to be tours of the Jewish quarter and two dinners and a VIP reception. And then this movie is going to show all over Holland and presumably eventually all over the world in any place that's having a Jewish film festival or that's interested in the history of colonialism, which wasn't always bad. I mean, it's an interesting and quite unusual movie, and I'm really looking forward to the weekend.
We will hear more about it when you get back. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Hi, I'm Ben. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can help provide a Jewish education to families at no cost to you by redirecting your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. You can help make Jewish education affordable.
Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. This lets JETCO give scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K through 8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction or donation. When you give to JETCO, you get 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income taxes are reduced by the exact amount you've given. Supporters of JETCO can give up to $1,053 for a single filer or $2,106 for a married couple filing jointly and get that whole amount back from state income tax.
Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442. Or you can go to JETCO.org.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One day, all the staff of the Finkelstein and Cohen law firm is called into the managing partner's office, but one at a time. Finally, only Bernie, the newest, most junior associate lawyer, is sitting nervously outside. Finally, it's Bernie's turn to be called in. He enters the office and sees the managing partner and all the other law firm partners seated solemnly around a giant table. "Bernie," asks the managing partner, "have you ever slept with my secretary, Miss Ginsburg?" "No, sir. Certainly not," says Bernie. "I would never do such a thing." "Are you absolutely sure?" asks the managing partner. "Absolutely, sir," replies Bernie. "I've never laid a finger on her." "Would you swear to that on top of the Torah if I asked you to do so?" asks the managing partner. Yes, sir, replies Bernie. I swear on the Torah I've never had a sexual relationship with your secretary." "Excellent," says the managing partner, smiling at last. "Then I'd like you to be the one to fire her." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Lech Lecha, which includes God's great command to Abraham, Lech Lecha me'artzecha u'mimolatetcha u'mibeit avicha. Leave, go from your country and your homeland and the house of your father to a land that I will show you. It's the beginning of monotheism, of the belief in one God. It's the beginning of Judaism. And it will prove to be the beginning of our connection to the land of Israel as well. It's a dramatic and powerful moment. The fascinating thing about Lech Lecha is not that God commands Abram, later to be renamed Abraham, to leave everything he has known. After all, if he is to create a new religion and remake belief in our world, he will need to leave polytheism in a pagan society that doesn't recognize the concept of justice and divine power, a corrupt, dishonest, ethically failed civilization. In other words, if you want to live a life of goodness and blessing, sometimes you need to leave home to do it. So Abraham picked up. He left the sophisticated, morally challenged city-states of Babylon and journeyed outward, westward, to find God, to found a new religion. That journey of differentiation was pivotal to all human history. If Abraham doesn't just do what God commands, then there is no Judaism, and no Christianity, no Islam, no monotheism, no Western civilization. But what's most fascinating about Abraham's actions in this week's portion of Lech Lecha is that after God commanded him to go, he just went, without argument or controversy. This strikes me as not a very Jewish approach. After all, the essence of Jewish culture seems to be argument and discussion. If you were directed to leave everything you'd ever known and told to move somewhere unspecified, wouldn't you complain at least a little? And don't think for a moment that Abraham is incapable of arguing with God. He proves in next week's Torah portion of Vayera that he'll argue and bargain with God to the last degree, as he does trying to defend the few righteous people in Sodom. No, something else is at work here. The essential understanding that sometimes you just have to move on. Leave what you know. Embrace the journey. In order to fully realize who we can become, we must first leave who we've been. It's an exciting, exhilarating, daunting prospect, dangerous yet essential. But if we choose to take the first steps, we, like Abraham, may reap rich rewards. Prior to World War II, European Jews were known as among the most enthusiastic sponsors and collectors of art, especially Impressionistic, Modern, and Expressionist art. The Nazis knew this and stole many valuable collections from their Jewish owners before sending most of them to their deaths. The process of restoring that art to the families of its original Jewish owners is still going on nearly 70 years after the end of the Holocaust. It involves museum collections and vast hidden stores of great art held by the families of former Nazis and Nazi collaborators. Hear about the latest dramatic developments in this fascinating story from an expert on the subject, Professor Jonathan Petropoulos, when we return in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaki Tribe.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A baby girl was killed and eight people injured last week when a terrorist hit them with his car outside the Ammunition Hill light rail stop in Jerusalem. Police confirmed that a Jerusalem police officer shot the driver dead after he tried to flee from the scene on foot. A spokesman for the emergency services says three people were seriously wounded and another two were moderately hurt. Four more sustained light injuries. The three-month-old girl died after being rushed to Hadassah Hospital. Her name was Chaya Ziso. Shimon Halperin, the infant's grandfather, said that the Ziso family had been returning from prayers at the Kotel when they were driven into by the terrorists as they dismounted from the light rail. The Arab terrorist driver was a resident of Silwan, the Shiloach neighborhood, and a member of Hamas. He had served time in an Israeli prison for terrorism. In other news from Israel, an Israeli hospital confirmed last week that it had just treated the daughter of Ismail Haniyeh, Hamas's top leader in the Gaza Strip, just weeks after the brutal war between Israel and the Islamist terror group Hamas. Avi Shushan, a spokesman for Tel Aviv's Ichilov Hospital, said that Haniyeh's daughter was hospitalized for a number of days this month. His daughter was treated in Israel following complications during a standard medical procedure in Gaza. Israeli authorities allow injured and ill Palestinians to leave the Gaza Strip and seek care at Israeli hospitals. Haniyeh's mother-in-law and baby granddaughter were also treated in Israel in the last year alone. Israel and Hamas fought a fierce 50-day war this summer that killed more than 2,100 Palestinians and 72 Israelis. Half of the Gaza dead were Hamas terrorists under Haniyeh. Haniyeh, the former prime minister of Gaza prior to the reconciliation with Fatah and the establishment of the unity government, Haniyeh has repeatedly called for Israel's destruction. He has refused on countless occasions to disarm Gaza or Hamas. During the summer war, Israel bombed Haniyeh's Gaza home. The Hamas leader was not hurt in the raid. He was hiding in the Gulf at the time. Only in Israel would the most militant terrorist enemy's family members be treated by the finest Israeli hospitals and doctors, while he himself continues to advocate and even try to direct Israel's destruction. Wow. In other Gaza-related news, Hamas's armed wing is rebuilding an attack tunnel damaged by Israel during Operation Protective Edge. The newspaper for the movement admitted that renovation work was carried out in the tunnel under the protection of a humanitarian ceasefire even during the Gaza war. A reporter for Al Risala, a daily, joined tunnel diggers under the Gaza Strip border with Israel. The diggers were described as bees in a hive. They said they were motivated by the belief that every inch they dig helps spill the blood of an Israeli soldier or kidnap one. "We thank God for making us soldiers specialized in tunnel digging," one said. "True, the work is difficult, but we remember our reward with God, and it becomes easier." Israel launched its ground incursion in the Gaza Strip July 17th, 9 days into Operation Protective Edge, just to destroy dozens of tunnels dug for the purpose of kidnapping Israeli soldiers or carrying out large-scale terror attacks against targets along the Israeli border. That same day, Israel intercepted 13 Hamas terrorists who had entered the country through a tunnel, emerging near Kibbutz Sufa. By the end of the war in Gaza, back on August 26, the IDF had destroyed 31 known tunnels leading into Israel, but officials admitted that one or two tunnels could have gone undetected. During a tour of an exposed tunnel last week, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said he was shocked by the tunnels used for the infiltration of terrorists, but fell short of calling for Hamas's disarmament. A spokesman for Hamas's Al-Qassam brigades indicates that Hamas still maintains its offensive tunneling capabilities, offensive in both senses, and called on young men to join the ranks of Hamas fighters. "The men of Al-Qassam are fine. The weapons of Al-Qassam are fine. The tunnels of Al-Qassam are fine, thank God," the guy said. "Our men will begin the next battle with their feet on the ground of Nahal Oz in Israel and the other settlements on Gaza's periphery," which are all in Israel proper, by the way. One Hamas terrorist said that he and his fellow terrorists had spent 12 days in the tunnel and wrote on the wall, "We wish to either be martyred underground or win above ground." Lovely. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Professor Jonathan Petropoulos. He's professor of European history at Claremont McKenna College, an expert on the Nazi looted art of World War II, its restitution, and we've been discussing the immensity of the problem, just how much the Nazis stole, making them perhaps the greatest thieves in the long history of human theft. You mentioned earlier in the show that around 1950, the U.S. disbanded its Monuments Men division. The Cold War, the Korean War, so much else to worry about. In the 1990s, there was a re-engagement with the problem. How did that start?
Well, there were a number of factors that surfaced in the 1990s that induced people to focus on this issue of Nazi art looting and restitution. One was the collapse of the Soviet Union and the opening of archives in Eastern Europe, so there were new research opportunities. Also, the recognition that the Soviets, the Red Army Trophy Brigades, had taken away approximately 2 million objects at war's end and only returned about 1.8 million of them. So there are about 200,000 so-called trophy works in Russia today. And so that complex of issues came into focus, and that was one factor. Also, the revelations about the Swiss banks, right, that they had taken deposits from European Jews, many who had perished in the Holocaust, and they had often not return the money that they had demanded, proof that someone had died in the Holocaust. And as people have said, they did not give death certificates at Auschwitz. And so that was a whole complex of problems. And additionally, there was a discovery that many Nazi leaders had Swiss bank accounts. And so whether it was not giving back Holocaust victims their money, or their heirs the money, or Nazi leaders' accounts, the Swiss banks had a lot to answer for, also including their trafficking in Nazi looted gold. So that was a second factor. And then third, there was the realization that American museums had Nazi looted art, that until World War II, the museum landscape in the United States was pretty unremarkable. There was the Metropolitan Museum in Boston and Cleveland and some very fine museums, but American museums blossomed. They flourished in the post-war period. You know, there's an axiom that art follows money, and America was the wealthiest country in the world after World War II, and this is when we founded our great museums, and we built our collections, and naturally, there were Nazi-looted artworks that found their way into these collections, and because there had been a kind of historical amnesia, if you will, about Nazi-looted art, or kind of a feigned amnesia is perhaps a better way to talk about it, you know, these collections required scrutiny, and so with the opening of archives, the Swiss banks, and the focus on American museums, it all came together rather remarkably in the mid-1990s.
Let's talk more about museums. Artworks come into museums' collections through donation, through purchase, a variety of other ways. They are supposed to check the provenance of the work, correct?
They are supposed to, yes.
But obviously, they're not always as scrupulous about that as we would like them to be.
Especially in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s. For about 40 years, there was very little done in the way of due diligence to vet collections. I got to know Thomas Hoving, the very flamboyant director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and we would have lunch, and he was so uncensored and just a wonderful person to talk to. And he said, "If you know, we never check the gifts, you know, and if I wanted something, I would have bought it from the devil." And there was such a fervor to collect, to increase the size of the collection at that point, it became kind of standard operating procedure to accept the gifts or to buy the works and really not ask questions or not carry out the research in a serious way. And I think that has changed now, 1990s, and museums do a great deal more today. They really don't want to be on the wrong side of this issue. But there were, as I said, 40 years when museums collected art with very little in the way of an investigation.
Now, certainly some of the pictures, I'm sure it's a small fraction of what's held in museums, have been identified as having been either literally stolen or forced sales by Jewish collectors in the pre-war period, many of whom died at the hands of the Nazis. It's not been an easy process getting those works back or getting some sort of compensation to the families, has it?
You're right. It's very difficult to recover an artwork in America or in Europe, from a museum or even from a private collector. The legal landscape is very challenging, and you know, and museums have not been as cooperative as I had hoped they would be. Back in the late 1990s, when this problem resurfaced, museum officials came forward at international conferences and made pledges to do the right thing, basically. There was an important conference in Washington, D.C. in December 1998, and that yielded the so-called Washington Conference Principles. And a key principle was that museums would find a solution with the claimants that was mutually agreeable, mutually acceptable. And there was this recognition that a lot of time had passed, and there was going to be gaps in the provenance, there was going to be shortages of information, but museums were committed to doing the right thing and to letting these claims be adjudicated on the merits, you know, on whether the work was stolen and restituted. And at that time, museum officials, I think, were really afraid of bad publicity that would come with rebutting a claim from a Holocaust survivor or an heir. But that seems to have changed subsequently, and maybe it's a product that you know, artworks are so valuable now. I was involved with the return of the five paintings by Gustav Klimt to the Bloch Bauer heirs, this great Viennese Jewish family, and when the works came back in 2006 and the five paintings were sold, they sold collectively for $329 million, right? That's a lot of money, $329 million. And so whether for whatever reason, museums are much more aggressive now in dealing with claims, I think especially for valuable artworks. And very often they engage outside counsel, very effective law firms, often on Park Avenue and what have you. And all these lawyers know how to do is fight fiercely, if you will, and fight with every resource at their disposal. But this is really not consistent with what the museum officials had pledged back in the late 1990s, because the outside counsel now will do things like exclude evidence. They'll invoke the statute of limitations. They'll invoke the doctrine of laches, which means why didn't you go after the work earlier? And they use these defenses, I would call them technical defenses, to rebut claims and to challenge the claimants. Sometimes the museums even sue the claimants proactively. You know, someone goes to the museum and says, "I think this painting might be mine or my family's," and the museums have filed lawsuits against the claimants even before the claimants have said they're going to sue or anything. So museums now, or their counsel, tend to be very aggressive in responding to claims, and I find that very disappointing.
More than disappointing, it's remarkably amoral. Let's talk about the incredible cache of art that Cornelius Gurlitt had sitting in an apartment in Germany. First of all, it's a complicated story. His father was an art dealer of somewhat Jewish descent, a little bit of Jewish descent, who worked for the Nazis. Let's talk about sort of what the ultimate resolution of that is and how it all came about.
Right. Well, Cornelius Gurlitt, who passed away about 6 months ago, was an elderly gentleman in Munich who was found to have about 1,300 pictures in his apartment. And he had also stashed a few others in a residence in Salzburg, and some of his family members near Stuttgart had artwork. These were works, well, there's four different kinds of artworks among the 1,300. Category one is art that was owned by the family for a long time. It was a very prominent family. The grandfather had been the rector or the president of the Technical University in Dresden, you know, very illustrious, as you mentioned, partly Jewish German family. And so some of the art is family owned, and that's fine. That's not problematic in any way. A second category is work that the Nazis declared degenerate, so-called degenerate art, modern artwork, works that were purged from German state collections between 1937 and 1941, and Cornelius Gurlitt's father was a sanctioned dealer who sold off this purged work, and the father, Hildebrand Gurlitt, purchased about 300 of these works at very low prices, an average of about $4.75 a picture. Mm. Some of these works are worth millions of dollars today. They have not been subject to restitution. The deaccessioning, the selling off of the state collection, was viewed by the Allies in the post-war period as the act of a sovereign government. The Germans were entitled to sell off their art if they wanted to, even though I think that's a complicated decision. It was based on a law that Hitler decreed, and whenever one views one of Hitler's decrees as a legally binding law in the post-war period, it raises questions for me. But that's the second category, the so-called called degenerate art that was sold off. The third category is works belonging to German Jews who were under duress, who were trying to emigrate and had to liquidate property in order to get out of Germany. And Hildebrand Gurlitt, Cornelius Gurlitt's father, he was buying this art, again, at bargain prices. And so there is an element of duress with these works. And then the fourth category are works that Hildebrand Gurlitt bought in the German-occupied territories during the war, especially in France, because Hildebrand Gurlitt, although a quarter Jewish, he became a key agent for Adolf Hitler and the planned Führer Museum. And especially later in the war, Hildebrand Gurlitt was probably the most important dealer for Hitler. And in the process of buying works for Hitler, he bought works for himself, enriched himself. And so there are works of that kind. For example, a very lovely Matisse portrait of a sitting woman that we know came from Paul Rosenberg, a very famous French dealer. So there's different kinds of property in the Gurlitt cache. And there's an expert commission that's been assembled in Germany to sort it out and to study it and hopefully identify the Nazi-looted works.
You know, there was calling it a bubble would be a little bit of an understatement. The Bavarian state kind of sat on this for 2 years, didn't contact any of the Jewish previous owners, didn't do anything about it, except sort of categorize it, I guess. It was then taken over by the German government at a higher level, but it's still kind of controversial what's going to happen to all of these, isn't it?
It is. I think the German government has not handled the Gurlitt cache very well. As you said, they knew about the paintings for quite some time, and yet they didn't take any real concrete actions. There was at least where there were quiet investigations, but you know, considering some of the work was looted and Holocaust victims are dying every day, that we're seeing this generational change, I think it was incumbent upon them to come forward, go into the public realm much earlier. And when they did, of course, it was a media firestorm, and they really had to scramble how to respond. And they came up with a solution that they were going to give this expert commission 1 year to study the 1,300 pictures. And I'm not sure this is a very satisfactory solution. It takes a long time to research an artwork, the provenance of an artwork. It's very painstaking work, and it requires travel and going to archives and library work. And I think the project is just too large, too vast for this expert commission to carry out thoroughly in the 1 year time frame. And I was recently in Germany. I was there several weeks ago, and speaking to my cohort in the restitution field, and they said that the research seemed to be proceeding very slowly. They weren't impressed with the initial reports that have come out from the task force, and I fear that the time clock is going to expire, and we won't find many of the works that were in fact looted. Cornelius Gurlitt, just before he died, he named the art museum in Bern, Switzerland, the Swiss capital, as his heir. And just last week, the museum stated that they would accept the gift, the bequest. And so the work will go to the works will go to Switzerland, at least those that are not returned. And Swiss law has never been favorable to claimants. It's very difficult to recover stolen property in Switzerland for a variety of reasons, including this notion that if one is a good faith purchaser in Switzerland, one has good title to the property, and it can be completely stolen, without a doubt. And in Switzerland, it makes it impossible to recover the work. So the fact that Gurlitt's art is going to Switzerland is not very encouraging in terms of further restitution work with this collection.
I want to thank Professor Jonathan Petropoulos for a great visit here on Two Jewish, talking about this Nazi-looted art. I don't suppose we'll find another cache the size of Gurlitt's, but who knows? Fascinating how this story continues to go on and on and on, and sometimes introduces new injustices into a long and painful story. Thank you so much. Where can people go to find out more about this?
Well, there's some great resources on the internet. There's the European Commission on Looted Art, based in London, and they have a website, lootedart.com, I believe it is. Or when Googles or Bings, this European Commission on Looted Art, they bring together press clippings and much more, and I think that's a great starting point.
Thanks again, Jonathan. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community.
Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Professor Amy Jill Levine, the Jewish professor of Bible at the Vanderbilt Theological Seminary and the author of the new book, Short Stories by Jesus. Tune in to find out why it's a very Jewish book. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish is the classic Yiddish song Tum Balalaika, as sung by Andre Ochoa. May you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Steht a Bocher on a Tracht, Tracht und Tracht a ganze Nacht, Wemmen zu nemmen und nicht verschämen, Wemmen zu nemmen und nicht verschämen. Mädel, Mädel, will bei dir fragen, was kann wachsen, wachsen an Regen, was kann brennen und nicht auf Erden, was kann winken, weinen an Tumbala, Tumbala, Tumbalalaika, Tumbala, Tumbala, Tumbalalaika, Tumbalalaika, Spielbalalaika, Tumbalalaika, Freilich soll sein. Narische Woche.